be careful about who you bring in, and if you just target the right tenants, you'll be fine.
Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it. Hello and welcome back to Pillars of Wealth Creation. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. With me, excited to have Ryan Cha. Ryan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Todd. Excited to be on the podcast. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate you coming on. And man, you are, or you were, a pharmacist turned real estate investor. You've recently retired from pharmacy, and so we're going to dive into that and your why on replacing what, you know, at least I feel like would be a good job, right? So, but you've invested in 15 properties, single families, duplexes, triplexes. You're working on a flip right now, and you did that all during your full-time job, and were able to replace your salary. So, with that said, Ryan, give our listeners a bit more about your background.
Yeah, actually, so I'm a pharmacist, or I was a pharmacist. I eventually retired. I'm 31 right now, so I retired recently. I got started, though, back in 2016 because I was inspired by my grandpa, who had a few properties in the San Francisco Bay Area. He bought back in the 50s. We all know that those houses appreciated like crazy. The rents went up. He was able to retire early and help also fund part of my college tuition and that of my brothers. So he basically built this generational wealth for our family. And of course, I was like inspired to get into it and carve a path for my future children as well and build another legacy of my own. So I got started in 2016. I worked a lot of overtime, 14 to 16 hour shifts to save up enough money to put into real estate because it was all my own money when I got started. And I bought one property a year. After about 5 years, I became a millionaire. And I was making multiple six figures in rental income because what I would do is I would rent out by the bedroom. So I'd charge like $600, $700 per bedroom. That means every house that I have with five or six students makes like $3,100 to $3,700. Our largest one makes about $6,500. And so, yeah, I just kind of took off from there. I bought some in California. Some one in Alabama, nine in Cleveland, Ohio. And so, you know, I have a pretty diverse portfolio right now, and my goal is to eventually hit 100 properties.
So these are, I'm assuming, student housing by campus.
Exactly. Yeah. So back single when I was families, in college,
you have single family duplexes, that type of stuff.
Exactly. I would say 70% of them single family. The other 30% is duplexes or a triplex.
So when you're renting them out by the bedroom, you're not, so are you furnishing then? If you rent out a bedroom, do you have to like furnish kind of the common areas, or how do you do that?
Yeah, usually I do furnishing. Every once in a while I'll encounter a group that already has their own furnishing, so they'll just bring over their furniture. But generally, yes.
Yeah. What kind of, so student housing, what kind of issues do you have with student housing? Do you have any just non-student housing? Or is it all
student?
So I'm
a little bit of a hybrid model.
Okay.
I will take students. I will also take professionals. So a lot of the people I bring in are also residents, or they're doing their fellowships at a local hospital, and residents and fellows usually stay for like 2 or 3 years a lot of times. So they're a great tenant base as well. And I find that college students are really great too. If you're looking at people who are more taking more serious degrees, like let's say medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, law degrees, engineering, that type of deal. So a lot of my students are actually grad students just because most college housing does not provide housing for grad students. They mainly focus on providing housing for undergrads. So there's usually this huge grad student population that just doesn't have any housing. and they're forced to either stay in nearby apartments or nearby houses.
What's the biggest kind of pitfall that you've encountered with student housing? I know a lot of people, and quite frankly, so I own quite a few properties in on or near campus and absolutely love them, but I hear a lot of times from people like these horror stories with the tenants and stuff like that. What's kind of been your biggest challenge?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think one of the things that people worry about is that you'll have like party tenants, fraternities, that type of deal. And that's not the case if you find the right people. And so, like I said, really focusing on that grad student population where at least a few of them are focused on getting like a medical degree. They really want to use the house to study. They want quiet time, quiet studying environments, essentially. And so if you have even just like one or two of those types of people at the house, they kind of police the other tenants as well. Because if another tenant's like, oh, I want a house party, the doctor, and he's like, no, I got finals,
No.
right? I got midterms
Yeah.
and
No.
finals. Sorry, guys, we can't do that. So I find that if you bring in the right people and just kind of talk to them, a lot of times I even ask them what they're studying for, what's their major, and I'll try to place people accordingly. But yeah, like I said, if you just get the right tenants, that isn't as much of an issue. But when I started off, I did have a guy who was a partier. He smoked marijuana back when it was not legal in California, unfortunately. So I just kind of learned my lesson from that. I was very desperate to find people to just stay at the house, and he was actually part of my fraternity, and I knew he was allowed. Kind of guy, like to party and things like that. But I was like, well, I don't have anybody else. But
Yeah,
that was a big mistake
stuck
for
with this
me.
guy.
So always, be careful about who you bring in, and if you just target the right tenants, you'll be fine.
Yeah. What do you make the parents co-sign? One of the things that I've done that's been
Yeah.
successful is I a lot of times, now if they're graduate students, a little bit different, but if they're undergrads, I typically make the parents co-sign.
Yeah, definitely. Whenever I can, I'll have the parents co-sign on the lease. That kind of is like an extra layer of protection. And let's say there is something that goes on with the tenant, you can always go to the parent and say,
Yeah.
hey, this is what's going on at the house. Can you guys
Right.
step in? And that'll
Yeah.
work. That
You know,
happened for the first tenant.
yeah, I just I've owned properties in near campus since 2009, and I've never had an incident, quite frankly. And I don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm sure the people I rent to party and have a good time. They're just not throwing big bashes, big keggers, stuff like that, at least that I'm aware of. And if they do, they're good at hiding it and they keep it clean. We had one group of boys, it was just two guys, that I don't even, I can't call it trashing the place. They caused a little bit of a mess, right? And they didn't paint, they didn't clean, their walls were dirty and stuff like that. But the parents co-signed. And so I called the parents up and said, hey, just so you know, there's a bunch of damage to the property. Your son's not going to get their security deposit back. And the dad
That's
showed
it.
up the next day and they fixed everything. And
Oh,
it
really?
was in
No
mint
way.
condition and
That's
better
amazing.
than when the kids moved in, right? So having that parent co-signer, if anybody's listening, you're like, hey, I want to do these college rentals. Just having a parent co-signer when it's appropriate is, it can be a huge advantage to your part, at least in my opinion.
I've definitely had like parents like visit the house and they're like
Yeah.
vacuuming and cleaning up everything. I'm like, I didn't even have to hire a cleaner.
Right.
Nice.
Right.
Right.
And then I want to say to the parent, like, you got to stop. Like, what are you doing? Make your kids do that. That's what I like. This guy's there. He's like painting the apartment. I'm like, what are you doing? This is your kid that damaged this place. I'd be like, dude, get your butt over to that house and clean it. Like, you have to paint that house. Otherwise, you owe me a bunch of money. Like, come on, man. But,
Yeah, there's a lot of safety behind that for sure.
so you are rent when you were saying you're renting by the room, you're renting to, Jim over here, and then you got Andy over here, and they don't know each other necessarily. You're just kind of trying to pair them up. Is that what you're doing, or are you writing to
Yeah,
groups that?
sometimes. So sometimes
Okay.
I'll get like a group of guys or a group of girls or maybe even co-ed friends, and they're
Yeah.
like, we don't want to stay in the dormitories because you have to stay in a room with somebody else and have roommates, and it's very loud, it's very crowded. But we want to stay with our group of five or six friends. But apartments, they don't have units that have like five or six bedrooms, right? So we kind of fill in that niche where we have a group of friends. Maybe they're all like on the swim team together. In fact, one thing you could do is talk to the school coaches and say, hey, we got these houses available. If your swim team is looking for housing next year, we have this. And so I have like a swim team at one of my houses. I've had like a tennis team, just as an example. And
Yeah.
so a lot of times you do have people who have friends, and then like junior or senior year, they all want to move off campus and live at a house together, study together. They all have the same classes, so it just kind of makes sense for them. They share notes and things. So that's great. Sometimes though, I do have individuals who apply individually. So I will try my best to basically match people up based off of their major, their interests, that type of deal.
So somebody who wants to get near campus, what do you look for in properties that you say, hey, I feel like this one's going to be successful. We can buy this. And how do you find those deals? Is it just straight MLS, or where are you finding these deals?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's definitely a system and a process to this. I usually start off with looking at where the top colleges are. If I'm looking at the state of California, for instance, I'll look at where are the top colleges in California, what kind of grad programs do they have, and I'll try to invest in those schools because that's where the top students will go, like students with 3.0 GPA, well-rounded, really focused on getting that professional degree potentially. And so that just tends to be a better quality tenant. Somebody's getting straight A's and really focused on their studies, they're not going to want to throw a wild house party and smoke and everything like that, for instance.
Yep.
So I start there, and then I'll look at the
Are
median
you
home
looking for
pricing.
growth too on the college, or do you care about that?
Yes and no. Yeah, like I like to see colleges that add on more programs throughout the years. I like to see that for sure. The first college I invested in, though, they started off in 198 four or sorry 1849 or something like that. So they've been around for a long time. So I know that they're going to be around for another couple hundred years or forever, right? There's no stopping, for sure. It's a private college as well. I do actually do like private colleges.
Yeah.
They tend to charge a little bit more, and so if you're able to afford a tuition, you're able to afford the rent, generally speaking. It's
Yep.
just a different type of tenant a lot of times. So I look for that. Then I look for the median home pricing around the area. Obviously, investing near like Stanford, you have multi-million dollar houses, it's going to be very hard to make the cash flow, potentially. It all depends on interest rates and everything. But so I'll look for lower median home pricing. Usually around 200,000, low 300,000, if possible, because that will ensure that you have good cash flow, like 1500 to 2500 or more a month in cash flow. And then I will look specifically for houses that are pretty large in square footage. So I want to try to get five or six bedrooms at each house. In fact, six bedrooms is a really good sweet spot because if you have two bathrooms, that's enough bathrooms for six people. After you go to seven or eight, it starts getting to you might have to add bathrooms to the house, et cetera. But six people, everyone, feels pretty comfortable with that number. Plus, you're making about $3,600 in cash flow if you charge $600 per room and it's six bedrooms. So that's kind of what I generally look for.
Yeah, and by the way, one tip here, because I deal with a market that you cannot have more than four unrelated adults in the same house. So check your local ordinances. Don't go buy a house that has six bedrooms and you can only rent four of them out, or have to be really cognizant of how you rent them out. That could really change your strategy. So I think that's
That's a
super
great
important.
point.
I don't know how many cities you that is even applicable to, but I know where I am in Minneapolis and St. Paul, if you have it, basically you want a four bedroom, because if you have a five bedroom, it doesn't do you any good, right? It just doesn't add any value to you.
Yes, and what I would say is be careful with those laws. Talk to a local real estate attorney. They'll be able to tell you, like, okay, well, we might be able to do a change of use permit where you change of use of the house to a rooming house or boarding house. Maybe we can have more tenants that way. Or maybe you do like a zoning variance, but obviously that could be a more complicated process. It really just depends on the city. And a lot of cities do realize that the school is not able to provide enough on-campus housing for students, so they know that students have to naturally stay off campus. But they also want to thread a certain line where the neighbors are not super pissed off about like a frat house developing or something like that. But yeah, generally speaking, like I've never really had problems with neighbors complaining about our college kids. But, and
Same
plus, you do have
here.
families of six people at a house.
Same here. We've never really had problems either. We actually have in St. Paul, there's a zone near some of the private colleges. There's several private colleges really close by to each other, and so there's this zone where you actually can't have a single family as a rental unless it's already a rental, right? But if there's, I can't remember exactly the law, but if there's a rental house or duplex, I think it's triplex or under, within so many feet, you can't get a rental license on that house,
Interesting.
or duplex or triplex. So basically, they're not allowing like every house in that area to be a rental. They
I
still
see.
want it to be a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so you have to be aware of that. I ended up buying a single family house out of foreclosure, and I got lucky because it actually was allowed to be a rental,
Yeah.
but it was in that zone, and so I had to learn about the law
Oh, yeah.
before. But
It's like low density, high density housing, right? But attorneys like the best person to talk to, and they'll be able to say like that's their job is to know that type of stuff. A real estate specific attorney, yeah.
How about new housing? Are you paying attention to what's going in the market? What's going on with, apartments being built and other development happening?
Yeah, to be honest, it doesn't matter so much to me about what's going on. I mean, obviously, the specific neighborhood, I want to make sure it's safe because students care first and foremost about safety, especially the parents. If they're driving through the neighborhood, they see trash everywhere and homeless walking around, they're going to go like, is my child even safe there? Are they going to, get mugged or something, right? So we do provide security cameras. The Ring system is one I would recommend. But we also invest in safe neighborhoods for sure.
I think
Sorry, I
that's
missed the
really
question.
important. Just because it's close to a college campus doesn't mean it's safe. Like, be aware.
Exactly. So that's the biggest thing.
I don't know if you know anything about Marquette in Wisconsin, but it's a private college, just located smack dab in a terrible neighborhood. Right. So if you literally go outside of like the campus walls, like there's, it's dangerous. Like you can get mugged, you can get shot. Like it's dangerous. You don't want to live off of campus.
And a great resource I recommend for people if you want to find, the best neighborhood to invest in that is lower median home pricing still and affordable, is crimegrade.org. You can just type in your zip code into crimegrade.org. It'll give you a heat map of all the locations. Generally, I think, it's green if it's great, it's yellow if it's in between, and red if it's not as great of a neighborhood. But take it a little bit with a grain of salt sometimes because, we don't know how often those maps are updated and, neighborhoods gentrify and get better. So,
Oh, that's a big one too. Be cognizant of what's happening in the neighborhood. Just because it's colored red doesn't mean that it's not rapidly improving.
Yeah, exactly. So local
Sometimes it's good to buy
realtors.
when there's blood on the streets, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people buy in emerging markets, and that's one of the smartest things to do. Yeah.
Ryan, you've got a flip happening right now, and there's some fun challenges going on. Walk me through this flip and the challenges you're having.
Yeah, for sure. So, the challenge at the very beginning was it looked like a great flip, but we had two problems. The contractor that we typically use for our renovations, he wasn't as experienced doing a full-scale renovation, like a full house flip from the studs, right? And so what happened is he estimated a certain cost, and then he ended up increasing his estimate by about $70,000. We're like,
Wow.
okay, hold up. This
What
probably
was
just not going to make
the
sense.
original
It was
flip?
originally less than 200,000. It was like
Okay.
180, I think it was the first
Okay.
one he gave. And then it went
So
up to like
increased it like
two.
50%.
Yeah, it went up like a ton. Yeah, exactly. And so what we had to do was actually find people who are experienced specifically with doing large scale flips, new builds, that type of stuff. Because they can give us bulk pricing. A lot of times, if you, for instance, buy materials, you can buy it all from one place and ask them to give you a big discount. So you go to Lowe's, ask them to give you a discount on a certain amount of items, then go back to like Home Depot and say, hey, Lowe's gave me this estimate. Can you guys beat it? And they will actually try to beat it. So you can kind of do that. So there are a lot of different changes when doing a large scale flip versus like small renovations to put up bedrooms, right? Another challenge was we think. We haven't confirmed yet, but our realtor may have overestimated at the beginning how much we could sell it for. So it's really important to be very comp based driven. Really look at the houses around the area, what your house is going to look like at the end of it, how it compares to the others. That will determine what your after repair value will be. And then just finding the right team. So we spent literally like 1 to 2 months just vetting contractors, and that's all we're doing, just trying to find contractors, talking to their references, seeing pictures and videos of their work, talking through our design with them, see what their thoughts were. And it just kind of gave you a lot of it gave us a lot of insights. And where should we put the HVAC units and the ductwork? How should we structure the master bathroom? All these types of things. And just having all those perspectives and vetting, and I always highly recommend vetting a minimum of three really good qualified general contractors whenever you're doing your first flip, for instance. So doing that whole process was definitely the biggest challenge for us.
Yeah, thanks for walking us through that. Is this a property that when it's all said and done, you could rent out in cash flow, or does it have to sell?
We believe it could cash flow. But most likely, we're going to be selling it relatively soon. Yeah.
One of my favorite strategies when I was flipping a lot of houses was to buy a house and say, I could cash flow this if we can't sell. Our strategy is to sell it, right? But look, when we sell this, it's going to make us X amount of money. And if we can't sell it and we're stuck with it, it still cash flows, $300 a month or something like that. So we always looked at that multiple exit strategy. And that was really my favorite way to flip houses. Now it didn't work all the time. And as the market got hotter and hotter and hotter, it worked less and less and less, of course. But yeah, if you can, if you want to flip a house and you've got that multiple exit strategy, that's definitely a big risk adjustment that you can
Oh yeah.
capture there. So,
That's really smart. Yeah, definitely something you always want to look at, because what's the alternative if the project goes to crap, right? Like you have to know what your other exit will be. Totally agree there. Very smart.
as a you went to college to and you became a pharmacist. Why did you choose the passive, sorry, the active investing route versus going a more passive style, and keeping your, a pharmacist makes pretty good money. How much does a pharmacist make?
When I
31 year
quit,
old
it was around
pharmacist.
$90 an hour.
Okay. So
So
good money.
it's a good amount. I think like 200K a year.
Yeah.
There's like bonuses and overtime and all of that. So
Sure.
yeah. PTO. Yeah, that's a great question. So I wanted to be able to get hands-on experience at the beginning because I feel like Okay, eventually I'm going to step back. I know it's eventually going to be like completely passive. We have teams and people taking care of everything, but I wanted to be able to know how to train those teams and people if we hit an obstacle. Like, let's say we're getting vacancies, right? I want to be able to experience it myself first so I know, like, okay, where do I turn? What are some solutions here? So that when I do hot train my teams and people, which we're doing right now, by the way, basically they'll be able to create that system and know how to do things on their own rather than me having to, like, not know exactly what's going on there, right? So I decided to just get my feet wet, get as much experience and develop as many skills as possible, so that when I do automate everything, I can make sure that the system runs very well.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. It's hard to implement a system if you don't know what can go wrong. So it's nice to have the bumps and bruises along the way. It sucks to have them, but it's nice to have them to where you can say, okay, we got to do it this way. This is a better way. And so I can train people in to do it this way. What is a maybe one of your bigger mistakes, or just a mistake that sticks out in your mind right now as we're speaking, that you made, and how have you learned from it?
Yeah. So the first mistake I made was on my very first property. I got a call, I think about 4 months into it, and the tenant that moved in was like, "Man, there's like sewage that's coming out of the kitchen sink. It's all over the kitchen floor. It's backed up into the showers, and it's sewage, and it smells, horrible. Like it smells like sewage." So I had to call up a plumber. It was like at 11 p.m. at night. I had to call up a sanitation crew. They found that the line was broken. We had to replace the sewage line. It was like $9,000 or so because it was a pretty long line. And I was like, man, is this going to happen throughout the rest of my journey, right? And so to prevent that in the future, I learned that during the inspection phase, you really want to dig into the property. Like, always get a sewage lateral line inspection. That way, you can say, hey, seller, this is how much it costs to replace the line. Actually, get an actual quote in writing that you can send to the seller and show them, like, this is how much it costs. If you don't want to put this up, then, we have to come to some sort of agreement here, or we might back out of the deal. And a lot of times I've been able to have the seller pay up to at least $10,000 in closing costs. I think our biggest seller paid about $20,000. They brought the price of the property down $10,000, and they paid like $10,000 towards closing costs. So it really does make a huge difference doing all those inspections and the due diligence.
Well, look, there's just certain things you can't see. I mean, Ryan, if you're buying one of my properties and you are doing the due diligence and you tell me, hey, man, I got to get a price reduction because there's old windows, I'd be like, go buzz off, right? You saw those windows, you knew they were old. Like, come on, man, just get out of here. But if you go, hey, man, underground, there's problems with your sewer. And here's the report, and here are the costs. Like, oh, crap. Like, I didn't know that, right? Of course I gotta work with this guy because I didn't see it, right? I couldn't, it's not there. So that's huge on inspections. First, be smart about it in front end. Like, look, if you see it on, tell the seller about it before you make the offer. Like, hey, I see your windows are all bad. I got to replace that, please. This is why I'm offering 200,000 versus 225,000, right? But if you don't see it and you do your inspection, a buyer or seller is going to work with you more than likely. And if they don't, well, they don't. Like, you just have to walk away, right? But there's too many. I've made that mistake. And I'll tell you a perfect example. Like, we just bought an apartment complex, 124 unit apartment complex, and we did sewer scopes, and we noticed some issues with what was going on with the sewers. If I didn't notice that, we ended up renegotiating with the seller because of it. If I didn't notice it, it would have cost us about $500,000, 500 grand. Like,
Jesus.
you know what I mean?
Out the window.
A lot of people wouldn't have because they don't do that thorough of inspections. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So important to do.
Yep. What's your vision? You're moving forward. Where are you going? Where are you trying to reach?
Yeah. So I love student housing. I actually started buying rentals, student housing rentals, pretty much a year after I graduated from pharmacy. I got my pharmacist degree. So, I love, and it was actually my first one was at my alma mater college at it's UOP in Stockton, California. And I just rented out to like pharmacy school students, dental students, some of my old friends potentially. People I knew, and I kind of had this connection with that college, and I love doing it just because it feels very rewarding. You are providing this affordable housing, you are providing this service. I even had this student who was in pharmacy school, and he's like, "Hey man, I know you're at a working at Kaiser as an infectious diseases pharmacist. Can you just give me some advice for like how I should set up my career path so that I can achieve that as well?" And then, I was able to tell them what clubs you should consider, organizations, what type of internships to get into, that kind of thing, right? So I like giving back to the community, and I always felt drawn towards that, and that's why I kind of did this. The other thing is, of course, I was able to scale faster because I would double the rental income at a typical single family home. Rather than renting it out for 1500, I'll be able to rent it out for 3600. Make a lot more cash flow so I could continue to buy more and more student rentals and grow the legacy, grow my legacy. But it's a win-win situation because the students themselves, they're paying half the price of on-campus housing.
Right.
So, I'm always going to be into student housing, even 10 years, 15 years from now. And my goal is to just, I bought like nine in Ohio this last year and a half with my uncle. And my goal is just to continue to grow like that, build our brand, build our reputation, provide the very best student housing, or be the best student housing provider in the areas that we're in, and kind of chase that excellence, I think it's, if like Tom Brady, right? One of his things is like chasing excellence. And it doesn't really matter what's going out around you, as long as you do become a better person tomorrow than you were today, or just make a 1% change and 1% improvement every single day. To what you do, that is a very fulfilling life. Because when I was young, I was like, man, what's the meaning of life? Why am I here? What am I doing? And I think eventually I came to that conclusion, I just want to be a better person every day. Like just try to chase excellence, master what I do. And that's very fulfilling for me.
Yeah. That's awesome. These are, I'm assuming, long-term holds. You're not trying to find the property that has the most amount of equity, rent it out, and then sell it.
Correct. Although I did sell my very first property, I bought it for 262,000. I sold it for 437,000. It was in California,
Not a
and there
bad
was just
deal.
so much equity in it. It was paid off and everything. So I was like, okay, well, with this amount of money, I can buy like eight rentals over out in Ohio because it's a lot lower, home prices. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna go ahead and do that. So every once in a while, I may sell a property, so that I can put that into investments that maybe have a higher income return or something like that.
How is owning your own business? I'm going to give you a positive and a negative. So, how's owning your own business been negatively impacted you? Or maybe don't want to sound that bad, but how has it like caused disruption in your life? Owning your own business, owning your own
Yeah,
real estate.
the good part about the 9 to 5 is you know exactly what to expect. You get a paycheck at the end of every month, right? And that's it. You after 5 p.m. or whatever, you don't have to worry. Like, unless you're in tech business, maybe they have you do after hours stuff. But for me, it was like you go home at 5, you're done, right? For business, it's a little bit different, right? If you have an emergency problem, like I think one time we had our pipes freeze and then they burst and then the place was like raining inside the house. That
That's a
was on our
joy.
flip, by the way. You got to deal with it, right? You're the guy, unless of course you build that system, and that's what we're slowly doing is having teaching others how to handle those types of situations.
Still
But
going to have to
yeah,
handle
business.
them though, to an extent, right? It's still
Yeah,
going to be the phone call,
yeah.
still going to be the notification. It's not like it goes away
Yeah.
completely. Now, do you have to go to the property if you have
Oh
the right
no,
systems?
definitely not.
No, right? Do you have to deal with it? But you're still going to hear about it. It's still going to affect
About it.
your pocketbook too.
Exactly. And so part of it is developing that mental fortitude. But I think one thing is if you do it long enough, you kind of just get used to it and it doesn't really affect you mentally. You're like, oh, it's another Monday. You know, it's not that big of a deal. And you kind of get really good at dealing with kind of like your emotions as well and understanding how your psychology works too. And so like I read a lot of mindset books and kind of developing that type of fortitude and developing that leadership is something. I know we're talking about how it negatively impacts you, but
Well, I
the
want to know
negative
how it
actually,
positively impacts you too. So
yeah.
that was kind of where I was going with it. Look, being an entrepreneur, it is a tough. It is tough. It's challenging. There's days where it's like this sucks. Like I'm getting beat up, right? I'm losing money, I'm losing
Yeah.
sleep,
Yeah.
people are calling me bad names, whatever it is, right? But then there's the good
Yeah.
part too.
Right. Oh yeah, for sure, man. I've had people are like, what is wrong with you? Like, you're a scummy landlord, that type of stuff. It's like, yeah, you know, they're just it's a complaint, you know. People complain. Everyone complains, right? It's just a complaint. But yeah, I totally agree. It's it's kind of tough. I mean, that transition, not everyone's prepared for. I don't think you can necessarily ever be prepared for it, but eventually it becomes pretty normal and it doesn't really affect you as much. You know, you learn how to handle those emotions, you know, how to handle situations, take leadership or train others to take charge for that.
Absolutely. Okay, Ryan, I got a couple last questions and we're gonna wrap up. So, what's a favorite book you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, for real estate, if you haven't read it, of course, Rich Dad Poor Dad, by Robert Kiyosaki, and of course, like Millionaire Real Estate Investor by Gary Keller. I think that one's good for like thinking in terms of your long-term vision. Where do you really want to, like, how do you want to build a multi-million dollar, $1 million rental portfolio? Because it really focuses on teams and systems, and those are the core, like, foundational things every business needs, right? So getting into that type of thinking is like, how can I build a team? How can I build a system? Is really important. So that's why I would recommend those books. I would also recommend, I know we said one book, but I would also recommend Traction eventually. Maybe I don't know what your portfolio, you know, your audience's portfolio is like necessarily, but after you get to like three or four rentals, you have to start really thinking in terms of systems and Traction is a great book for that.
Love it. Love it. What's a way you like to give back?
You know, I'll take out a lot of time of my day just to I mentor others as well through this process. So I'll spend a lot of time just like giving really good advice to, or well, what I would think is great advice at
Your
least,
best
for
advice
like
you can
how,
give.
yeah, like advice for how I handled it at least. And I spent a lot of time on that. I spent a lot of time like building my relationships with tenants as well. Because I, you know, I've been in their shoes as well. I know if there's like a really long renovation, like they're tired of all the drilling and they're trying to study, you know, I get it, right? So I like connecting with them as well. I think that's a great way to give back. You don't necessarily always have to give back monetarily. Sometimes even just giving back emotion wise and just connection wise is really big.
I love that. All right, so last question before I wrap up. What are your three pillars of wealth creation?
Yeah, so I define wealthy as not just I mean, everyone thinks of financial wealth, right? But I think there's two more important ones than finances, actually. If you were on your deathbed, right, what do you think about? And it's definitely not finances,
No.
right? So number one, I would say, is your health. So for me, I do jiu-jitsu 3 times a week, 3 to 4 times a week. I really enjoy it. I'm part of a community. I, keep active. I stave away pre-diabetes or diabetes or whatever. So I think number one thing is health. And if, you feel overwhelmed and everything, you don't feel like you have enough time, you can make time for your health. Like if you do that, you're going to think faster, you're going to move fast, everything will just become more efficient faster, and you'll feel healthier, you'll feel better about yourself every day.
Yeah,
And
if
you'll
you've got
waste less
30
time.
minutes in your day, you can figure out how to do something to
Oh
improve your
yeah.
health.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say that's number one for sure. And I know a lot of people slack off on that, but for me, it's, yeah, you cannot slack off on that. It's a non-negotiable. Number two is relationships, of course. So relationships with your family, your spouse, your children, your loved ones, friends. Sometimes, when you're getting older, you have to be more intentional about setting aside time and meeting up with your friends, right? And
Yep.
I think that's
That's
super,
tough.
yeah, that's definitely second for sure. And then the last one, I would say, I actually didn't mention money in this one, but I would say fulfillment or impact. What kind of legacy do you want to leave for your kids? How do you want to be remembered? What do you enjoy doing? And what's really great about real estate investing is that it really does create that point of you have this passive income coming in, and it's leveraged income. Other people are kind of handling your operations, and so you get to choose what to do with your time, rather than feeling like, I have to go 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and being stuck with that until 65. Maybe you still like that job. You can do it 2 days a week, or 3 days a week, or 1 day a week, right? And what's great about the real estate is it frees up your time so that you can pursue what you like doing and your passions, and you could travel and, spend time with the people you want to spend time with. So
Yeah.
that was the biggest thing for me.
Love that. Ryan, if you were to go back in time to, 2015, 2016, I think you said you bought your first property in 2016. So if you're going to go back in time to when you're thinking about that first property and doing your research and all that kind of stuff, what would you do differently now? Like, how would you change, or what it maybe not even differently, what advice would you give to your younger self that was just starting? What would you say?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, I hear this question a lot, but I would say one of the things I subscribe to is not having regrets, because even when you make mistakes, they could be blessings in disguise. Because what I say is, like, that $5,000 mistake saved me $100,000 from $100,000 mistakes when I reach a portfolio of, 20, 50 properties, whatever, right? So it's good to, I mean, don't feel bad making mistakes. That's part of the process. And it actually teaches you more to make a mistake than to just have everything be smooth sailing all the time, right?
As
So
long as you pay attention.
yeah, exactly. So yeah, definitely always get your takeaways from it. Like, what did I learn from it? Do a debrief. But yeah, I think for me, I would say, don't be afraid of failure. Don't be afraid of making mistakes, because that just keeps most people paralyzed from even getting their first deal. Like, you just got to get into it. Even if you lose money. And I think most investors at some point during their life, they lose money on something, but then it teaches you, right? Teaches you how to scale faster, or it teaches you how to build relationships better. It teaches you how to be a better leader.
Yeah, I've got a mentor who's been in the industry for a very long time, and he said, one thing I can promise you is you will lose money if you do the business for a long period of time, you will lose money. And if you don't, that means you're not taking the proper risks to grow and challenge yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
So don't be
yeah.
afraid of it. It's better than throwing your money into GameStop and losing it that way, right?
Unless you
That
did it right at the right
probably
time.
lose
Yeah.
money. Yeah, you don't learn much from that necessarily.
No.
But
Love
yeah,
it.
I mean, it's fine, right? The money will always come back to you. Just continue along with it.
Awesome, Ryan. Really appreciate the information. We covered a lot of different things, a lot of good advice in here. How can our listeners get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I do teach others how to do this specific type of investing, student and professional investing. I have a free PDF of how I do it, some of the strategies I use, some of the advice I would give, and things I learned, like mistakes I made and learned from. And that's at www.newbierealestateinvesting.com/guide. Again, that's www.newbierealestateinvesting.com/guide. And newbie is spelled NEWBIE.
Love it. Ryan, man, again, appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. And listeners, look, just go back and take notes. Hopefully you took notes, but go back and re-listen and really just grab one thing from what Ryan and I have talked about today and apply it to your business. One, maybe it's a mistake, maybe it's, whatever it is, and apply it to your business and make a difference today and continue to improve.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you being a loyal listener. Say, I would love to have you go on to our Facebook page and subscribe, give us a thumbs up, go on to iTunes or wherever you listen and give us a rating and review. Don't forget to subscribe. Your rating and review just helps us push this out to more and more people and continue to grow our audience and hopefully positively affect a ton of people out there that really need this and want this. So, the other thing I've got for you is a free ebook on my website. So go on to venturedproperties.com, venturedproperties.com, and download our free ebook on real estate and on syndication. And I've got some data points in there, some really good stuff for you. So I'd love to have you take a look at that. It's free. I'm not expecting anything from it. And also, look, if you want some help in multifamily, want some help learning, growing, getting your business off the ground, I would love to talk to you about what it would look like to work with me potentially and see if that's a good fit. So you can go to coachwithdex.com and check that out, and we can definitely have a call. Thanks a lot for listening. You make it a fantastic rest of the day. I'll catch you on the next episode.